Welcome to a Juno Afternoon on Monday, October 24th, 2016. I'm your host, Scott Burton. On today's show, we'll learn about the Downtown Business Association's Main Street and Style-O-Rama meetings. We'll get a preview of tonight's Women of the World concert at Thunder Mountain High School. Mary Lou Spartz will be here with details about Tuesday's memorial, remembering the survivors of the sinking of the Princess Sophia in 1918. In KXLL's Annie Bartholomew will tell us about this weekend zombie walk. Those interviews, National Native News, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note Music, and more right here on a Juno afternoon. Currently 49 degrees in downtown Juno.
With National Native News, I'm Art Hughes, in for Antonio Gonzalez. Police in North Dakota arrested more than 100 people as clashes with Dakota Access Pipeline protesters continued over the weekend. It was the largest number of arrests since protests began, China Lockett reports.
More than 45 Morton County Sheriff's deputies dressed in riot gear met a group of around 300 protesters walking towards a site where pipeline construction equipment was parked. The crowd chanted, prayed, and burned sage while helicopters circled close overhead as they walked a nearly three-mile path. The deputies then pepper-sprayed members of the crowd. In a press release later, the sheriff's office described the scene as a riot and that the pepper spray was necessary to protect themselves. Rob Keller, spokesman of the Morton County Sheriff's Department, says the action was necessary to maintain the public's safety.
Anything that is peaceful, there is really no issue. But when it takes into consideration when you're walking across fence lines and walking into people's property, we are law-abiding in this country, and any time a law is broke, there are consequences of it, and that's what happened here.
It was the latest clash in the months-long conflict near the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation. More than 200 people have been arrested so far. The Obama administration halted pipeline construction on U.S. Army Corps of Engineer land near the Missouri River, but construction is legally allowed on private land where developers have permission. For National Native News, I'm China Lockett near Cannonball, North Dakota.
Standing Rock Sioux Tribal Chairman David Archambault II is calling for the U.S. Justice Department to intervene in what he calls clear strong-arm tactics, abuses, and unlawful arrests by law enforcement. In a statement released over the weekend, Archambault said law enforcement officials are engaged in a disproportionate response to the protesters' nonviolent exercise of their First Amendment rights. A group of protesters set up a roadblock on a rural highway near the construction zone. They removed it after talking to officials. A second group set up another roadblock with vehicles, hay bales, and other objects. Some Native American voters feel they're being left out in the cold in the presidential election. Former Democratic candidate Bernie Sanders was the only one who routinely spoke about issues important to Native voters. Now he's campaigning for Hillary Clinton. In the coming weeks, National Native News is taking a focused look at election issues for Native Americans. Ramona Morozas caught up with one family at a Sanders event in Duluth who remain hopeful the other candidates will take Sanders' lead.
Ojibwe voters Andre and Dennis Day Bungie took their fifth-grade daughter to see Bernie Sanders' campaign for Hillary Clinton at an event at the University of Minnesota Duluth in early October. Dennis says Sanders was his first choice for president. Now he's left with two candidates who have failed to speak up for Native people. The Standing Rock Sioux fight against the Dakota Access Pipeline is a key issue.
One of the reasons why I'm here is because I'm hoping to hear if he has to talk about the DAPL, you know, what's going on in Standing Rock.
Sanders has publicly spoken against the pipeline construction before, but he didn't mention it this night. He did address other issues related to Indian country.
Another area where there are very significant differences of opinion between Mr. Trump and Secretary Clinton.
That is the issue of climate change.
More than 2 months after Sanders lost the Democratic nomination to Clinton, Andrea holds up his comments as the standard.
Bernie Sanders has been the only candidate through this presidential campaign that I feel like has spoken to the audience of Native people.
You know that this is the wealthiest country in the history of the world.
The family says without Sanders in the race, Clinton has their vote. For National Native News, Ramona Morozas and Kate Harrison in Duluth.
And I'm Art Hughes.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support by the University of Tulsa College of Law's online Indian Law Master's Degree Program to help you work effectively in Indian Country. Spring application deadline is December 1st. More information at 844-573-3934. Support by the Albuquerque Hispano Chamber of Commerce's Convention and Tourism Department, providing complete convention and visitor planning services to Native American conventions in Albuquerque. Information on convention and tourism services at siabq.org.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Monday, October 24th, 2016. Scott Burton, your host. I've been joined in the studio now by Dana Herndon. She is the communications specialist with JEDC and also part of the Downtown Business Association, or at least in partnership with it. Welcome to the show, Dana.
Thank you.
Yeah, nice to have you here. And with her is Sydney Mitchell. Some may know her as the owner of Shoofly. Otherwise, she is a board member on the DBA, or Downtown Business Association. Welcome to the show, Sydney.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's nice to have you both here. So a couple things on your agendas. The first one's on November 1st. But before we get to those events, tell me a little bit about the Downtown Business Association, Dana, and how the JEDC partners with them.
Well, the Downtown Business Association is comprised of downtown businesses. Our reach goes from the Rock Dump to the Breakwater Inn, so we cover a pretty good area, including the Willoughby District, too. And we've been very busy this year. The JEDC partners with the DBA because we our goals align in terms of downtown revitalization and making downtown a thriving place for businesses and for people to live. This year we'll be, well, actually next week, we're going to be hosting a public meeting featuring a Main Street America expert who will help us conceive like a public or collective concept for what we want in downtown in the future, and then projects and plans on how to get there. So it's going to be a really exciting process, and we really encourage everyone, business owners, property owners, residents, and anyone really in Juneau to come and check it out. We think downtown is an important part of our city for everyone, and it's really beneficial for everyone if it thrives and we have a really solid core.
So that's November 1st. What time?
It starts at 5 p.m. at the Red Dog Saloon.
Okay. So that's, it sounds sort of like a forum where you can get, you have community input, just thinking about the future of downtown.
Yeah, community input. So I guess some background. The reason why we're doing this is because in the Juneau Economic Plan, the DBA was tasked to come up with a downtown improvement strategy. And a way that the board thought we could do that was to become members of the Main Street America program. And the Main Street America program is an economic development program that helps downtowns, to help reach downtown revitalization. So it's worked in over 2,000 downtowns across the United States, downtowns with populations of all sizes. It's a market-based program, which means it looks at the unique strengths and assets that the community has and then develops strategies that are tailored towards that particular downtown.
Okay. Right. Sydney, as a business owner downtown, what are a few things that you might suggest at this meeting? What are a few things you'd like to see?
Good question. I think as a person who's lived in Juneau a long time, and owns a business, I really love downtown. And I love the diversity of the mix. And I love that we have independently owned shops versus big box stores. So the interesting thing about this Main Street program to me is that what we're seeing in the lower 48 is that with the advent of sort of big box stores and the internet, downtowns are huge vacancy rates in several downtowns across the United States. So this is a program that's here to try and show us ways that have already been proven in other communities so that we here in Juneau can have a diverse mix that includes retail, restaurants, service-based businesses that our community, that benefits our community, in addition to benefiting the folks who are operating those businesses, you know, kind of a symbiotic relationship.
Okay. How about you, Dana? I know you're part of this, but what are a few things you think would make downtown do better?
Well, I think I love downtown. I think it's a great place to just be. I would love to see more of a connection between people, a lot more people living there, and a lot more people just out and about, and having that really strong synergy between people going out and nightlife and access to recreation and events, more events downtown that include more, you know, like the whole block or whatnot. I guess just tying in the marketing side and the infrastructure and then the housing and everything. So just making all those things stronger.
Okay, so you can participate in our city's future, downtown's future, on November 1st at 5 p.m. at the Red Dog. Okay, Style-O-Rama. Tell us about it.
This is we're so excited.
5 days later at the Red Dog, right?
Yes.
Same place.
See, you can tell we love the Red Dog. So the Red Dog, Eric, is on our Downtown Business Association board and very supportive of what goes on in downtown. But so the Style-O-Rama is the second annual event. We started last year. And our goal is so much of what's in the media, and whether that's TV or social media, in the world of fashion is designed for people who live in big cities and designed for people who aren't really out in the weather and who are living a different life than we lead here in Juneau. And of course me, I love shoes. So my fashion decisions start in the morning when I wake up and I look at the weather and I think, okay, you know, what am I willing to do today? And then I'm going to build my outfit around what I'm going to wear on my feet. But it starts with the weather. And so what we're trying to do here, what all the local boutiques do, is we go out into the big world of stuff and figure out what makes sense, what's wearable, what's functional, and so that we can still have a bit of fun with style and yet still be functional. So the whole point of Style-O-Rama is to give local boutiques, and we have 13 participating boutiques this year, which is up from last year. Last year, we only had 8. And the goal is to show, to launch new products, new stuff, and to really put together stuff that a fashion show that helps women understand new ways to put together functional but stylish outfits for Juneau, for Southeast Alaska.
Okay. So it's a fashion show, here you say, for women mostly.
Mostly, although there are quite a few. We're seeing downtown in particular, there are a lot of men who are, you know, paying attention to, again, that sort of functional style. How can I, you know, maybe I don't want to just wear a certain kind of boot all the time.
Yeah, we have a boutique set that will cover both aspects.
About how many, you said, how many participants?
We have 13 this year. That includes Shoefly. So.
And so what's the scene going to be like? Like models with clothes on, walking, a runway? How are you going to do it?
Yeah, well, full disclosure, my husband owns Alaska Renovators, so he's building us a runway. And so, yeah, we'll have a runway. We will have at least 26 models, probably 30 models in total. In the back room, getting ready and you know, getting psyched. We have a DJ.
We have a DJ. Two MCs. Mm-hmm. It's going to be high energy, a lot of fun, a lot of great music. A Red Dog's going to be putting together a signature drink for us.
Yeah. So there'll be a great, some kind of martini, I think. Mm-hmm. But aside from that, it's just going to be, it's very fun. Even last year, and so our goal this year, what Dana's been instrumental in, so she and I are collaborating on this event, and she's been instrumental at making some connections for new boutiques, and so we have a new boutique that's not even open yet that will launch at our event, Resolute Boutique, that's younger people who are putting together a really cool concept, and Trickster Rico Worrell is going to be launching a new clothing line, and so we're hoping to see that for the very first time at Style-O-Rama.
I know Aurora Project is going to be doing a really cool new decal and design on a new garment that hasn't been sold in his stores yet. So it's going to be really cool to see all these shops we know and love come out with something we haven't seen before.
And this is the second year, right?
Second year.
And weren't you telling me that a business was actually inspired to open because of this event last year or something like that?
Yeah, I think inspired is probably a good way to put it. Yeah, I reached out to the owners of Alaska Dames in Lillette out in the valley and worked with a really great guy downtown who manages a lot of the properties downtown, Daniel, and he was willing to allow business owners who don't have a shop downtown to use for free space he had available. So Lillette and Alaska Dames were able to participate last year along with a couple of other independent designers, and they were able to sell their stuff after the show in that space. As a result, Lisa and Alex at Alaska Dames thought, huh, you know what, maybe it is time to open a store in downtown. And they, you know, had met Daniel, and turned out he had a space, and so now we have Dames downtown, and it's one more shop downtown. Mm-hmm. We need more shops downtown. Mm-hmm. I think more independent shop owners will just make downtown so much richer.
Is Stylorama a ticketed event?
It is.
Where can you get those?
You will be able to get those online starting tomorrow. You can go to the shoeflyalaska.com website, and there will be a link there. We did sell out last year. We only were able to sell 100 tickets last year. This year at the Red Dog, we're able to sell 150 tickets, and there are, I think, 40 VIP.
Yeah, there's 42 VIP tickets, and that guarantees you prime seating and a drink.
And what's the cost of those?
Those are $30.
Okay.
And then what was the general admission?
General admission is $15, so there'll be 108 of those.
Yeah, so it's important to us to sort of keep that price down. This is an event for entertainment, and so we're trying to make it accessible to everyone and not be at too high of a price point.
Okay. That's November 5th at the Red Dog. Remind me the starting time for that.
Doors open at 5. Fashion show starts right at 6. And then from 7 to 9 is going to be the downtown shopping adventure. So as soon as you get inspired and energized at this fashion show, we encourage you to go downtown and complete the night with the shopping.
And Sydney, you said tickets at shoefly.com?
Shoefly Alaska.
Starting tomorrow.
Starting tomorrow.
Starting tomorrow.
And then, but before that, on November 1st, also at the Red Dog, is
also
the meeting.
5 p.m.
Also at 5 p.m.
Yes, and it's very important that everyone is there. So we really encourage everyone to come and give us their thoughts and opinions on downtown.
All right, Dana Herndon, Sydney Mitchell, thank you for coming on the show. Anything else you'd like to add?
Go to downtownjuno.org to get more information on the public meeting on November 1st.
Yeah, and I hope everyone makes it.
Thanks.
Slipping and a sliding with them new shoes on. Papa said, Willie, don't you rap no more. Way downtown, just fooling around. It took me to the jail. Told me, and it's all mine. No one stole my bail.
Fiddler, Fred.
I wish I was over at my sweet Sally's house, but sitting in that big armchair, one arm around this old guitar and the other one around my dear. Way downtown just fooling around, it took me to the jail. Told me and it told my, no one Now one old shirt is about all I've got, and a dollar is all that I crave. I brought nothing with me into this old world, ain't gonna take nothing to my grave. Way downtown just fooling around, they took me to the jail. Told me and it's all mine, no one to go my bail.
Support for this programming on KTOO is provided by Justin Parrish, Democratic candidate for Alaska State House District 34. Paid for by Justin for Juno, 7094B Sunny Drive, Juno, Alaska, 99801.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Monday, October 24th, 2016. Scott Burton, your host. Tonight at Thunder Mountain High School, Women of the World are playing. It's a Juno Arts and Humanities Council concert. And that's 7 p.m. at Thunder Mountain High School. Earlier in the day, Jeff Brown was able to speak with members of that group, and here's their conversation.
I'm on the phone with Ayumi and Deborah, members of Women of the World, who are performing tonight at the Thunder Mountain High School. Ayumi and Deb, thank you very much for being on the air with me today.
Thank you.
So tell me a little bit about Women of the World. What about the members of the group together?
My name is Ayumi. I'm from Japan, and I am the founder of Women of the World. And we all actually met at Berklee College of Music in Boston, Massachusetts. We are currently four singers, and we are touring with one percussionist, Patrick Simon from Canada, and singers are from India, Annette Philip from Italy, Giorgio Renosto, and from Boston, Massachusetts, and way of Haiti, Deborah.
Yes, I'm from Boston. Well, Berklee is an amazing melting pot of cultures. We have 105 different countries that are represented there. So you have the opportunity to learn pretty much any style of music from around the world. And Ayumi's vision was to create a group of women and men now from all over the world to come and share in their culture. So it was an amazing environment to start this type of a group.
Well, in what ways are you similar, and in what ways are you different?
Similarities, we all love to sing, of course, and we love music.
And we really love to explore different culture, different genres of music, and also food. So that's the kind of, and also love to travel, and those are the things that connect us. And differences, yeah, of course, we all have a different background growing up. So there are quite oftentimes miscommunication happen, or like, you know, none of our first language is in English. So sometimes we have a difficulty communicating. But in the basic, the fundamental of our group is to really respect and care and support and listen to each other. Sometimes we argue still, and there's, you know, sometimes tension and drama. But it's like our everyday life. We feel this is our family and sisters and brothers. So that this bond, I think, it's catering through our musical performance as well.
Your work is like a musical United Nations. Could you expand on that?
Exactly.
Could you expand on that a little bit, please?
Expand on that, yeah. We've had the opportunity to play with this group. How many people?
When we have a big show, we usually also have a world peace choir, which is singers from all around the world. We have probably 50 singers from different countries, and that was a very powerful experience. So, yeah, it's really like working as a United Nation, like represent each country and being the role model of the world.
How do you find your music?
We find it in a variety of ways. Sometimes it's just things that we can find on the internet, songs that we like, and then we just want to explore more of that culture. And once again, being so close to Boston and Berklee, we have many, many friends that are from different countries. And so when we ask, hey, do you have something to share? They give us all the music that they can. So we have an amazing volume of different cultures to explore. And also, what we see now on this tour in Alaska is the opportunity to travel to different places and see what type of music is there, what is the culture like there. So on this tour, we had the opportunity to go to Bethel, and we had learned a Yupik song there. So we're trying to get it good enough to be in our repertoire. So we have to practice. So.
Do you think they'll be playing that tonight?
Well, I think
it's a work in progress, but by end of this tour, yeah, we would like to sing in one of the concerts.
What qualities do you look for in a song when you're picking them out for performance?
There are many things to look for. Sometimes it's just the melody that's just beautiful. Different types of music have different harmonic elements. So we sing a lot of songs in Bulgarian, and this style of music has a very intricate harmony that's very characteristic of that region of the world. So that's what drew us in. Sometimes it's the rhythm, it really could be anything.
I'm talking with members of the Women of the World. They're performing tonight at 7 o'clock at the Thunder Mountain High School. You want to talk a little bit more about your music? And
sure. Tonight's performance is going to feature a myriad of places. We're going to take you on a trip around the world. And so we try to cater to whoever is in the band, whatever culture they come from, that we have a song from that region of the world. But we also try to be global ambassadors. We know that we're not from some of the regions that we perform songs from, but we try our best to get as authentically close as possible and really try to represent that culture so that people can have a really nice bridge, a gateway into another part of the world.
When you're learning a song, you're learning parts of that language. Do you learn lots more of parts of the language?
It depends on the song, really. There are some songs that, for example, we sing in Japanese, and Ayumi's from Japan. She speaks Japanese. I tend to really love Japanese music, so I learn Japanese. And there are other songs that we have only had the opportunity to learn the translation from a native speaker and, a little bit more about what makes the language sound the way it does. But, of course, with a big body of work, it's hard to learn a bulk of knowledge of the language, but of course we would love to find out more as much as we can.
Did you perform at the high school today?
Yes.
What was the reaction of the students?
It was amazing. They were really into it. We got them dancing and singing with us. It was a lot of fun.
I've been talking with Ayumi and Deb from the Women in the World. They're performing tonight at 7 o'clock as part of the series of concerts brought to you by the Juno Arts and Humanities Council.
Yeah, we've been so fortunate to tour around Alaska, and this is our eighth show and eighth city to visit, and we are so excited to meet lots of local people and share our stories and music. So I really hope to see many of you at the show.
I got my tickets.
Yay! Thank you.
All right, thank you very much for being on the air with me today.
And here is a sample of their music.
Você fala no escuro porque eu vou te dar. Tá de novo, tá de novo, tá lá que chega pro meu. Zombies are back
for the KXLL Zombie Rock.
When Juno's undead will stalk the streets in a flesh-eating flash mob.
With prizes for funniest zombie, most undead, and best celebrity zombie.
Meet in the Cope Park parking lot Friday, October 28th at 7 p.m.
It'll be a hair-raising good time.
More information at kxll.org.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Monday, October 24, 2016. Scott Burton, your host, with me in the studio now is KXLL's program director, also arts, culture, and music producer Annie Bartholomew.
How's
Welcome
it going,
over
Scott?
Over the Studio A. It's good to have you here. So you're usually over in Studio C, right?
Oh,
over
yeah.
Over in KXLL. How's life over there? What's going on?
Life at KXLL is totally excellent, as usual. Getting really excited about this new 80s compilation cover album we just got. It's called The Time Is Now, and the money benefits the Foundation for AIDS Research. But it's got the coolest cover as ever. Allo Block covers Billie Jean by Michael Jackson. Got Scarlett Johansson and her band Sugar for Sugar covering Bizarre Love Triangle. So good.
Nice.
And those are just the national names. Also playing the new Will Pullers album. Play the Boy Spaceman's got their big party Saturday night that we're sponsoring. So always a lot of cool, fun stuff happening in my world.
Absolutely. If some of our listeners maybe have never heard KXLL at 100.7, which I probably isn't anyone listening, but in case there are, how would you define the sound?
I would define the sound of KXLL as just kind of the best music of the last 60 years. With the big emphasis on music that's happening now. We play a lot of electronic music, but you'll also hear a lot of throwback stuff from the 60s, even the 50s. The 50s are coming back so hard right now. So we have a lot of artists who are not only honoring the past, but making music that sounds like it was written 50, 60, 70 years ago, and just really emphasizing the greatest stuff from every genre. So you're going to hear hip-hop, electronic music, folk music, acoustic music, and even hair metal sometimes when you just got to get down with it.
Right on. So beyond spinning great tunes, you do, like you say, you get behind certain events, and you have a couple coming up, right?
Oh, yeah. This Friday, going down at the Cope Park parking lot, we have our annual Zombie Walk, which is kind of like a zombie flash mob that crawls through the streets of downtown Juneau. Lots of really good makeup and outfits. People come from all over town. And over the past years, it's kind of swung towards a younger age group. When it started, it was a lot of the downtown bar scene. Started at Evergreen Cemetery, which they don't do anymore, just out of respect for the families of people who are there. So we switch it over to Cope Park parking lot, and we have a lot of kids, actually, which was very surprising last year.
And what is this, like the fifth year, sixth? It might be more than that. You know?
Well, the first one happened when I started college. So that's got to be at least like 5 or 6 years ago, yeah.
Wow. And about how many people usually participate?
I think we had about 80 last year. It was way too big for our after party at the Taqueria. So this year, our kind of after get-together costume contest is going to be held at Marine Park. So we're doing a candy giveaway, and we also got prizes donated from COPA and Gonzo AK for some of the best outfits we see there. Last year, it was really hard to give just one kid the best kid zombie costume. So we have 10 ice cream kid scoops donated by COPA. But the prizes are for most undead, funniest zombie, best celebrity zombie, and then, of course, the kids awards.
Nice. And so you start at Cope Park, and then you go up by the Governor's Mansion? Is that your route?
By the Governor's Mansion, and then we usually pose in front of the Capitol for a photo. I'm not sure we're going to pose this year. We like to get a big shot of the crowd and then walk down Seward Street. So you get to go past Shoe Fly, people eating dinner at Salt, the Rookery, and it's so fun to watch people kind of like press up against the glass and see what's happening outside. I mean, people will change the sides of the streets. Just because it's this huge group that covers probably like 100 or 200 meters.
And do your participants really get into it?
Oh, totally. Last year we had like zombie hunters. You know, we encourage people to make noises, get as gruesome as you want. Some of them were like too gruesome to put on Facebook. I mean, they're up there, but don't dig too deep.
This is 7 p.m. on Friday. It starts at Cope Park. Any hints for people dressing up?
What
makes a good zombie?
A good zombie, blood necessary, but don't forget to do like dark circles under the eyes. If you really want to, you can lighten your skin tone, but it isn't totally necessary. Like I always find the best zombies, they look like people, but people who've like been ripening for a while. But not too dead. I mean, be tasteful about it. I mean, because that stuff's really hard to take off later. I got some kind of professional blood makeup that we passed out on little Q-tips last year, which we'll have this year too, but it gets pretty sticky and gnarly, and once it's in your hair, it's a weekend project.
You start at 7 at Cope Park, and you get to Marine Park about when usually?
You know, it happens pretty fast, so 15 minutes probably tops. I mean, people are just so eager to like get down Sewer Street and show off their outfits that it's almost like a zombie run.
All right. And then prizes and all that gets handed out.
Oh, yeah. And there's going to be candy for everybody.
All right. And then the next night, Playboy Spaceman.
Playboy Spaceman is having their annual Festival of Three Skulls party. It's kind of like Halloween before Halloween. Halloween among friends. Playboy Spaceman's going to be doing a big set there, and it's just always a really fun time to get dressed up.
Remind me where that is?
That's at the Jack this year.
Okay. And what time does that start?
I think it's at 8 p.m., and you can get tickets online at playboyspaceman.com. It usually sells out, so.
Cool. Annie Bartholomew, thank you for coming on the show. Anything else you want to add?
Nope, just get your costume together.
We'll be right back. program support provided by Kindred Post, a full-service post office, gift shop, and community gathering space located downtown at 145 South Franklin Street and open 10 a.m. until 6 p.m. Monday through Saturday. More information at kindredpost.com or on Instagram at kindred_post.
This is Troy Quinn, music director of the Juno Symphony. Join me and the orchestra on October 29th and 30th at JDHS as we kick off the season with an electrifying concert of new and timeless classics. We open the concert with Sibelius' majestic Andante Festivo for strings. In a career spanning more than 1,000 movie soundtracks, world-class French horn soloist Jim Thatcher joins the orchestra to play Awaysin's dramatic horn concerto. Schumann's rousing fourth symphony promises to have you on your feet with an ending not to be missed. Tickets are at Hearthside, The Jack, JunoSymphony.org, and at the door.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday, the 24th of October, 2016. It's the birthday of the poet Denise Levertov, Ilford, England, 1923. She wanted to become a poet, didn't want to go to graduate school, so she got her nurse's training, spent 3 years as a nurse during the Blitz in London. She liked the work, but didn't like the structure, the organization. She said, "I was always crawling in and out of windows to avoid curfews." She met and married an American poet, Mitchell Goodman. They moved to this country. She got in touch with William Carlos Williams, whose work she admired. They exchanged letters for a while. Then she took a bus up to meet him in Rutherford, New Jersey. He was a warm man, and after that, she went to visit him a couple of times a year. Denise Levertov published more than 20 books of poems. Denise Levertov, who said, "Strength of feeling, reverence for mystery, and clarity of intellect must be kept in balance with one another. Neither the passive nor the active must dominate. They must work in conjunction as in a marriage." She said, "I'm not very good at praying, but what I experience when I'm writing a poem is close to prayer." It's the birthday of the playwright Moss Hart, born in Manhattan in 1904 into utter poverty. But his Aunt Kate, who was as poor as the rest of them, liked to live beyond her means. And among her indulgences was the theater. She liked to take trips to see Broadway plays, and she took her nephew along, and he was dazzled by it. Took any theater odd job he could find. He wrote a comedy which was all right, a producer told him, but not great, and the producer suggested that he collaborate with the playwright George S. Kaufman. And when the play was produced, it was a big success in 1930, the play Once in a Lifetime. They went on to collaborate on You Can't Take It With You and The Man Who Came to Dinner. Moss Hart also wrote screenplays, including Gentleman's Agreement. And he directed plays. The most famous was the musical My Fair Lady in 1956, a rags-to-riches story that he told in his memoir Act One. He died in 1961, Moss Hart, and his wife, Kitty Carlisle, refused to let his diary be published. She died in 2007, and the diary turned out to be full of nasty comments about people he knew, Dorothy Parker and Marlene Dietrich and Gene Kelly and Audrey Hepburn, whom he described as absolutely ruthless. Here's a poem for today by Philip Terman, Some Days. Some days you have to turn off the news and listen to the bird or truck or the neighbor screaming out her life. You have to close all the books and open all the windows so that whatever swirls inside can leave and whatever flutters against the glass can enter. Some days you have to unplug the phone and step out to the porch and rock all afternoon and allow the sun to tell you what to do. The whole day has to lie ahead of you like railroad tracks that drift off into gravel. Some days you have to walk down the wooden staircase through the evening fog to the river where the peach roses are closing, sit on the grassy bank and wait for the two geese. Some Days, a poem by Philip Terman from Our Portion, published by Autumn House Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Lumosity, with a 10-minute fit test to calculate baseline scores and training programs with 50 challenging brain games. Learn more at lumosity.com. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
You're listening to A Juno Afternoon here on Monday, October 24th, 2016. Scott Burton, your host, about 13 minutes until the top of the hour. Joining me in the studio now is Mary Lou Spartz. She's a poet, among other things, and she's also an organizer for Tuesday's memorial of the Princess Sophia, remembering the survivors of that tragedy. Welcome to the show, Mary Lou.
Thank you, Scott. I appreciate being here.
Yeah. Okay, so on October 25th, 1918, the Princess Sophia went down.
Yes, she did.
In case there are people that don't know the story, can you tell us about that?
Well, I'd be glad to. The ship was a Canadian Pacific Railway ship, and she ran along with other princess ships. There was a fleet of them that came up from British Columbia and came up to Skagway and back, and of course at that time there was a lot of activity in the Yukon, and especially coming from Dawson. So it was the last ship of the Prasaya was the last ship of the season before the holidays started, and so she was absolutely, everything was taken, and people were begging to get on because she was really packed to the top. And there have been talk of stowaways, et cetera. And there may have been. It's hard to know. She came down from, she was late getting out of Skagway because of a bad snowstorm, among other things. And she was off course about a mile and a quarter. At that time, then the navigational aids were very poor in southeast Alaska. So it was not, and there was a huge storm, just an enormous storm. And she got grounded on Vanderbilt Reef, which is south of Eldred Rock. And she was just simply stuck there forward from the wheelhouse to the bow. And so but this wasn't unusual for that kind of vessel or for that run. Other ships had been stuck on the rocks, and when the tide came in, they floated off if there wasn't any damage. And the captain ascertained that there wasn't any critical damage to the hull. And I have read that she was a double hull. So there was every reason to believe that she would be able to withstand until a good tide came in. But the wind was ferocious. The snow was ferocious. Everything about that storm was just monstrous. And it just continued and continued. If you've seen the pictures of her, and maybe you'd like to take a look at them, she's just standing upright. Looks like she's standing right on top of the water. So that was what happened on the night of the early morning of the 24th. At dawn on the next day, a series of small boats went out to the Sophia and requested that they be able to be allowed to take the passengers off. Among them was the King and Wing. And the Estabeth was the largest, I think, of the boats. And, of course, the Coast Guard cutter, Cedar, came to their rescue. And they all requested that they be allowed to take the passengers off. But the captain felt that the danger was too great for them to be able to successfully take the passengers off. So he denied that. And he also was concerned about salvage if passengers were allowed to get to be taken off, then the boat and the ship would be up for salvage. So his home company, his company in Vancouver, notified him that they were sending the Princess Alice, which is a sister ship, north to pick up the passengers and all would be well and they would get there and they would be comfortable. In the meantime, make everybody comfortable and do what you can. So the captain did, and the small boats kept going out. These were very courageous people that went out in these storms. There were times when the storm abated enough so that there might have been a possibility of getting them off, but it was still a very dangerous tactic. The storm continued until, I'm not exactly sure what time, but the wind shifted. And consequently, between the wind shifting and the way she was sitting on the reef, on Vanderbilt Reef, she started to move. And it blew her in, it blew the aft around to the point where she couldn't withstand that and sank.
Those winds must have been something to blow that boat like
yes,
that.
Yes, you're entirely right. It was just this unabating storm that just didn't seem to want to do anything but just descend on Southeast Alaska and especially on the ship.
Coincidentally, we have a high wind warning right now in Juneau. It sounds
yes,
like
we
it's going to pick up.
Same time of year.
You told me you have an obsession with the Princess Sophia.
Oh, yes, I think that's the best way to put it. But sometimes when you grow older, obsessions are good things to have.
Tell us how that developed.
Well, when I was a kid, I lived on 12th Street, and my house backed up to the cemetery. So my backyard was the cemetery. And I wandered around and read the stones. One day I read this stone about Walter Harper and his wife, his bride, actually, Frances Wells, who died on the ship and were buried together there in the Evergreen Cemetery. And I came home and asked my dad about it, and he said, oh, yeah, and then he explained the story to me. And I was fascinated because it was such a romantic story, and it was this grave was so enchanting to me. So I've been interested in it since I've been about 12 years old.
And they were two of the almost 353 people?
That's one figure, the 353. And I think that's probably pretty close. Not all of the remains were recovered. Some of them were washed out to sea. Captain Locke's remains were never recovered. He, of course, was captain of the ship. And so that's that. There, you know, the remains were scattered all along the beaches and the islands, Shelter Island, and all along the coast here from Eldred Rock down, and they had to be retrieved, and the community, Juneau, people volunteered to go out and retrieve the remains and bring them in to the community here, to Juneau. And there was a morgue set up in the area that is now the Sobolov Building, and they were identified there. Many of them were so covered with bunker oil, that's this viscous oil, very thick viscous oil, that they were not even recognizable as people. They were just more looked like maybe trees or something, you know. It was just, so they were brought in and cleaned and identified and recorded and made ready for those that were to be taken on the Princess Alice when she came to take the remains back to Vancouver and on to their own burial.
Okay. Mary Lou, I wish we had more time.
I do too.
To talk more about this. But if people have questions or want to learn more or participate, they can meet you tomorrow. Is that right?
Yes, we'll be meeting as a remembrance, as we do each year, at noon at the Evergreen Cemetery at the Walter Harper and Frances Wells graveside. And we'll have Father Gordon Blue will do a little ceremony there, a religious ceremony. Walter Harper was a protege of Archbishop Stuck. He was a famous Episcopal archbishop, traveled extensively in the interior and along the coast. And Walter Harper also was first man to ascend to the top of Mount McKinley, now Denali.
Okay. Well, thank you for coming on the show very much, Mary Lou. Again, if people have questions or want to learn more, you might be a good resource.
Oh, yes, I'm looking forward to people helping me with commemorating this sinking, which will be 2018. And we are going to commemorate that with a number of events that I'm looking forward to working on. And if I like ideas, and if anybody would like to help with that, my number is 780-4340. Please give me a call. I'd be glad to talk to you about what we've been doing and listen to your ideas.
All right, Mary Lou, thank you for coming on the show.
My pleasure, Scott. Thank you.
For tuning into a Juno Afternoon today, Monday, October 24th, 2016. Tomorrow, tune in and you can hear about this weekend's community reading of the new Harry Potter play. Lauren Anderson from the Treadwell Ice Arena and Sarah Lynn Tabachnik from Aware will be here discussing Wednesday Purple Skate. We'll talk with activist musician Emmanuel Jahl and we'll find out about elementary school instructional coaches. High wind warning in effect. And tonight calls for partly cloudy skies with a low around 32.